Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to cut through all that noise, bring together the best sources we can find, and really distill what matters so you can be truly well-informed. And today, wow, we're navigating some really complex, sometimes just bewildering territory. It touches pretty much all corners of our world. Okay, let's unpack this. We're going to start with the immediate ripples from the latest election results, some shifts in political power. Then we're diving into some, well, policy choices that are frankly sparking some serious questions about what's really intended versus the impact. And finally, we'll switch gears for a pretty crucial global economic analysis that honestly affects every single one of us. Our journey today is guided by some sharp political analysis from electoral-vote.com, always good for, you know, a surprising detail or two, and also an incredibly insightful economic perspective from Daniel LaCall. Our mission, like always, is to pull out those vital nuggets of knowledge, connect the dots between things that might seem separate, and hopefully give you that aha moment where it all clicks.
Yeah, and it's crucial to see how these different areas, politics, administration decisions, court rulings, global economics, they're all intricately linked. We're going to dig beyond just the headlines here, try to understand the underlying currents, broader implications. We really want to encourage you, the listener, to consider not just what's happening, but why it matters and maybe what it signals for the bigger picture.
Absolutely. So let's jump right in. Political shifts and signals. What the latest numbers tell us. We've got some fascinating special election results that are really giving us a peek into those power dynamics in Washington. First up, James Walkinshaw's win in Virginia, VA 11 specifically. Now, this isn't just some local story. It has immediate, like, direct consequences for the House. With Walkinshaw seated, Republicans now control 219 seats. Democrats have 213. That means Speaker Mike Johnson can only afford two defections on any vote. Just two.
That's incredibly tight.
It is. If three Republicans jump ship, assuming all the Democrats stick together, that's 216-216, a tie.
And a tie means the bill fails. Simple as that.
Exactly. It's a razor-thin margin. Every single vote counts. But, you know, beyond just the numbers, this win is leaving some interesting tea leaves on the ground, politically speaking. Walkinshaw won by nearly 50 points. It was 74.9% to 25.1%.
Huge margin.
No, okay, this is a heavily Democratic district, D plus 18, they call it. Leans Democratic by about 18 points over the national average. A typical Democrat might win there, say, 60-40. He overperformed that baseline by 30 points.
30 points is massive.
And he even outdid his predecessor, Jerry Connolly, by like 16, 17 points. Now, we should always be careful, right? Don't want to overread one special election in a superpartisan district. But still, what does that kind of overperformance signal to you? Maybe about voter enthusiasm.
That's a really crucial observation.
Yeah.
And it highlights how a fragile majority like this, it doesn't just affect the day-to-day votes. It can actually empower specific legislative tools in ways you might not expect. Like, take the Epstein Files discharge petition.
You need that magic number, 218.
Exactly. And reports say they have 217 signatures already.
Yeah.
So, assuming Walkinshaw, being a Democrat, adds his name.
Which seems likely.
Seems very likely. Then the 218th is expected around September 23rd from Elita Grijalva in Arizona. So this bipartisan push, actually gaining traction even with such a slim balance of power, it really shows how determined lawmakers can shift the agenda when the majority is this narrow.
That's a fascinating point about how that power balance can be, well, exploited or used. And speaking of local elections, let's look at Boston. They just had their mayoral primary. Michelle Wu just dominated. She took 71.8% of the vote. Josh Kraft got 23.3%. Boston, as you probably know, is famously a one-party town. I think the last Republican mayor was Calvin Coolidge way back.
Yeah, long time ago.
So it seems pretty much a foregone conclusion Wu gets another term.
And that outcome raises an important question, doesn't it? Mm. About money in politics.
Right.
The lesson we seem to learn over and over. Kraft, you know, backed by his family's wealth they own, the Patriots still couldn't really make a dent against Wu's popularity.
Mm.
It reminds me of what we've seen elsewhere. You know, L.A., maybe those Wisconsin Supreme Court races. Huge money doesn't always buy victory. And it also suggests Wu's popularity might be tied to her strong stances, like against Trump or ICE raids. It shows how local politics can mirror national trends, but also diverge. and how specific policy positions can really resonate.
Okay, so shifting from those specific results, let's look at some recent polls that are giving us some intriguing insights into the broader currents. First, this poll from the University of Texas Texas Politics Project. It's a real head scratcher. It shows Texas AG Ken Paxton, who's eyeing a primary challenge against Senator John Cornyn, remember, with a 55% approval rating among Texas GOP voters. Cornyn, only 42% with that same group.
That is pretty remarkable.
Isn't it? I mean, Paxton has this extensive history of scandals, we're talking serious controversy, versus Cornyn, who's seen as more of a, you know, normal Republican, decades of service. What do you think that tells us about voter priorities right now?
Well, it's a crucial observation because it really pushes against conventional political wisdom, doesn't it? What's really striking here is what it reveals about a pretty significant chunk of the, let's call it the Magenta voter base. Hmm. Paxton seems almost bulletproof, maybe,
yeah,
despite this whole left of scandals.
Right.
It suggests that for a lot of these voters, a politician's controversies, even ones that really challenge basic ethics, they don't necessarily hurt their support. It points to maybe a different set of priorities.
Mm.
Could be loyalty to an ideology or a persona that just overrides those traditional expectations of integrity.
Yeah.
It's a stark contrast, you know.
Mm.
The normal Republican faces more skepticism from the base than someone who's constantly tangled up in legal and ethical issues.
Okay, let's move to a different landscape. New York City, a New York Times Siena poll for the mayoral race. It shows Zoran Mamdani with the commanding lead, 46%, even against former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's pulling at 24%. Mamdani's numbers just keep climbing. Now, part of that could just be New Yorkers getting to know him better.
Sure, name recognition builds.
But there's strong suspicion, you hear it talked about, that the Trump effect might actually be helping Mamdani here. Donald Trump has come out really strongly against Mamdani.
Right.
And it's plausible some voters are thinking, well, if Trump hates this guy, he must be doing something right. Or maybe just using their vote to, you know, poke Trump in the eye.
An anti-endorsement almost.
Exactly. And finally, let's glance way ahead. A poll from St. Anselm looking at the 2028 New Hampshire primaries. Early days, I know. On the Republican side, J.D. Vance is dominating 56%. For Democrats, Pete Buttigieg and Gavin Newsom are tied at 23% each. Kamala Harris is way back at 6%.
Okay, interesting early snapshot, but definitely need some context there. New Hampshire, you know, it's highly educated, one of the whitest states. Demographics there tend to favor candidates like Buttigieg and Newsom.
Good point.
So while they're probably happy with those numbers now, it really highlights the challenge they face, right? Proving they have broader appeal beyond that specific voter base. And Harris's relatively low showing, despite having huge name recognition, it suggests these very early polls are maybe more about visibility, maybe regional appeal, than deep, widespread national support yet. All these candidates, they'll need to show they can connect with a much more diverse electorate to actually have a shot at the nomination.
You know, sometimes you read the news and you just have to stop and ask, what the hell are they thinking?
Yeah.
And that is exactly what we're going to dive into next, because some recent administrative actions are, well, truly baffling. Let's start with this incredible series of events at a Hyundai plant down in Georgia. The story seems to have started with a woman named Tori Branham, described as a conservative activist, maybe a conspiracy theorist. Apparently, she blew the whistle on undocumented laborers at the plant. This led to an ICE raid, 450 people arrested, mostly South Korean nationals. Many led away in handcuffs, shackles, detained for several nights.
It's just a huge operation.
Yeah, it really is. Hard to believe the scale, but that's what happened.
And this situation, it's just a fascinating study in unintended consequences. Okay, so on the surface, the administration's goal might have been, you know, act tough on undocumented immigration. Some key figures reportedly pushing for daily quotas.
Right, make the numbers look good.
Nearly 500 arrests. That might look like a win on paper. But the reality, it reveals a massive trade-off.
Yeah.
These weren't, you know, the fentanyl smuggling criminals often described in rhetoric.
Yeah.
Many were skilled South Korean workers. Some were perfectly legal. Others had visa issues that were more like red tape problems. And most intended to go home once the plant was running smoothly. So best case for the White House. They struck maybe a glancing blow against their perceived immigrant problem. But the cost. What do you think the actual cost was?
It sounds astronomical. Not just money, but relationships, trust.
Exactly. The cost was infuriating the South Korean government.
Wow.
Harming foreign investment. I mean, this plant is foreign investment.
We're fine.
And shutting down a production facility. So no money, no jobs, damaged supply chain. And then the administration later released the arrested South Koreans, flew them home on a chartered flight.
Which suggests.
Which strongly implies they recognized it was a massive screw-up, right? Mm-hmm. It points to a level of maybe internal disorganization, almost like a collection of fiefdoms, where one department's actions just completely undermine another department's goals.
Wow. You can just picture the chaos behind the scenes. Okay, next, let's talk about the uncharitable cancellation of the Combined Federal Campaign, or CFC. This is a federal program, been around ages. It lets government employees donate easily to charities through payroll deduction. It's raised over $9 billion over its lifetime. And it costs the government basically nothing because the charities cover the admin costs.
Sounds like a pretty good program.
It does. And yet, the administration issued a stop work order for the CFC. They postponed its website launch, and there are reports they're discussing canceling the whole thing.
Okay, that move immediately raises questions.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider the administration often talks about adhering to biblical principles, which frequently emphasize charity.
Right, you hear that rhetoric.
I mean, you look at Psalm 37.21, talks about the righteous giving generously. Luke 3.11, share with those in need. John 3.17. So, potentially killing a program that facilitates billions in charity, it seems to directly contradict those stated values. It's puzzling.
So what's the likely motivation then, do you think?
Well, the suspicion is that the goal is to target specific unfavored groups, maybe NPR, Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, who benefit from the CFC.
Oh.
But the problem is lots of other beneficiaries are totally neutral, like the World Wildlife Fund. Or even groups favored by a conservative base, like the Wounded Warrior Project.
So they can't just pick and choose easily.
Exactly. So the implication is, if they kill the entire program, just to avoid looking bad by only cutting specific groups, well, that seems incredibly petty. Self-serving, even. It's like weaponizing a long-standing government program for politics. And the impact could be really negative for civic engagement, for charitable giving overall, just throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
That's a really sharp point about the inconsistency and the potential ripple effects. Okay, let's move to something even more disturbing. The Charlotte murder as a political opportunity. This involves the tragic murder of Irina Zarutska in Charlotte, North Carolina by DeCarlos Brown Jr. Awful story, captured on video. The administration's response was immediate and, well, many called it extreme. Donald Trump went on what our source calls an unhinged rant on social media. Linked the crime to cashless bail, attacked the NC Governor Roy Cooper, endorsed Senate candidate Michael Whatley. We also saw these immediate sort of thinly veiled dog whistle comments from people like Elon Musk, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
Right.
Is this just standard political opportunism or is there something more going on here?
Well, what's really unsettling is how quickly, how instantly such a profound tragedy became a political tool. The administration has apparently been, and this is quoting our source, itching for what they call a predicate act.
The predicate act, meaning?
Meaning, like, a justification to allow federal intervention in cities. They've tried to manufacture similar pretexts before, apparently, but they didn't really escalate beyond minor things. But this murder, with its specific details, the young white victim, the accused black assailant with a distinctive appearance, the video readily available, it was seen as, and again quoting the source, manna from heaven.
Wow.
Yeah. A perfect opportunity to create that justification they wanted. The details were leveraged instantly to ignite outrage, push a narrative about urban crime being out of control.
But did it work? Did they intervene?
No. Despite all the rhetoric, the story ultimately didn't, as the source put it, boil enough blood for actual federal intervention in Charlotte. So it highlights this significant gap, right, between these really strong presidential pronouncements and what's actually actionable policy on the ground.
Okay, we've covered a lot of political and administrative ground there. Let's turn now to judicial interventions and the global economic outlook. The Supreme Court's been making some pretty significant moves lately. Donald Trump has secured two recent wins at the Supreme Court. First, the court allowed him, at least for now, to refire FTC Commissioner Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, who's a Democrat. A lower court had put her back in her job, but the Supreme Court put that ruling on hold.
And this has potentially massive implications. Huge. Traditionally, presidents can't just fire Senate-approved appointees on independent boards like the FTC without cause. There has to be a reason.
Right. They're meant to be independent.
Exactly. Trump's argument was basically just, because I say so, an inherent presidential authority claim. If that position is ultimately upheld by the court, it could totally redefine presidential power. It could turn hundreds of positions, maybe even including the Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell, into patronage jobs. Totally dismantling Congress's intent to insulate these critical roles from politics.
That's a huge potential shift. And the second win.
Second, the court agreed to hear two tariff cases. and on an expedited timeline, fast-tracked.
Okay, and what's the core issue there?
In both cases, the core question is actually quite similar to the FTC one. It's about presidential power. Is a president declaring a national emergency enough justification just because, again, I say so?
Without Congress, without clear criteria?
Precisely.
Hmm.
It could basically subvert what Congress intended when granting emergency powers, allowing presidents to use them almost whenever they want, instead of for actual real emergencies. And if you connect this to the bigger picture, it's worth remembering, SCOTUS has sided with Trump something like over 90% of the time on these emergency-type matters.
Wow.
But most of those were temporary stays, procedural things.
Mm-hmm.
These upcoming decisions, though, they're different. They're substantive, precedent-setting.
Mm.
They could fundamentally redefine presidential power. So these tariff cases, they're going to be a really key indicator of how the court plans to play its hand on these massive constitutional questions.
Okay, that's a lot to watch on the judicial front. Now let's transition to that economic analysis, Daniel Lakhel's perspective on the paradox of money supply and secular stagnation. His central idea is pretty stark, actually. He argues the impact of printing new money, new currency units, is diminishing. It's leading to what he calls secular stagnation.
Secular stagnation.
Yeah.
Basically a fancy term for a long period of little or no economic growth, right? Despite efforts to stimulate it.
Exactly. And look at the U.S. numbers he uses. M2 money supply, that's a broad measure. Cash, checking accounts, stuff easily converted to cash, had a record $22.02 trillion in June 2025. That's 4.53% growth year over year. But it's estimated to deliver only about 2.5% real GDP growth.
So more money isn't translating directly into much more growth.
Right. Compare that to 2021. M2 grew by a massive 26.6%, but GDP only grew 5.7%. Or 2022, 5% M2 growth, just 1% GDP growth. Lakhel basically says there's just no multiplier effect from all this new money being pumped in. So what's going on here?
Well, what's really illuminating is Lakhel's core argument. He says, this sort of anemic growth we're seeing in developed economies, it seems to require more monetary stimulus just to keep things afloat. But, and this is the key part, the bulk of this new credit, this new money, is being absorbed by government spending.
Not by the private sector.
Not flowing effectively to productive private investment, according to him. It leads to weak productivity, unproductive government expenditure. And he flatly rejects using COVID-19 as an ongoing excuse for this high government spending. He argues that spending is what has led to this stagnation, not stronger growth. It's kind of counterintuitive, right? The idea that just printing more money doesn't automatically lead to a healthy, expanding economy, especially if the government is soaking most of it up.
And this isn't just a U.S. issue, is it? He points to the U.K. and Europe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He holds them up as cautionary tales. The U.K.'s M3 money supply grew over 3% year over year, but their economy is expected to grow less than 1% in 2025, maybe even zero growth. And Lakhel explicitly blames bloated government spending, crowding out credit available for private businesses.
And the euro area.
Similar story. Euro area M2 grew about 2.76% year over year, but their five-year average M2 growth is almost 6%. And what has that gotten them? According to Lakhel, almost no real GDP growth, plus they're burdened by huge unfunded liabilities.
Hmm. So what's the global picture then?
Well, globally, Lakhel points out there's an estimated $123 trillion worldwide in circulating money M2 equivalents in 2025. And yet it's delivering what he calls the worst economic growth since the 2008 crisis. His argument is that central banks are basically prioritizing keeping the debt bubble afloat, which has led to global public debt just soaring, hitting $102 trillion in 2024. So you see this pattern. Central banks fuel higher government debt, maybe enabling irresponsible fiscal policies, which then crowds out the private sector, leads to higher taxes eventually, persistent inflation, even with low money velocity, and ultimately weak growth. It raises this really critical question about the long-term sustainability of how we're running things, fiscally and monetarily.
So the message for the U.S., if we want to avoid ending up like Europe or the U.K. in his view, is pretty clear then.
Absolutely. Lakhel's simple lesson for the United States, as he puts it, is very direct. To avoid that kind of stagnation, the U.S. must cut spending faster and allow the money supply to flow to productive private investment.
It's a really stark warning about the path we seem to be on, and in his view, the need for a pretty fundamental shift in economic strategy.
That is a lot to digest, isn't it? I mean, from those nuanced signals in special elections.
Mm-hmm. To these really puzzling, politically charged moves from the administration.
Right.
the critical role the Supreme Court is playing now in shaping presidential power.
Yeah, huge implications there.
And then these stark warnings from the global economic landscape about money supply and stagnation, it really does paint a complex but definitely interconnected picture of where we are right now.
And that's exactly why understanding all these different elements is so crucial for you, the listener. They're not just isolated incidents happening in silos. They are threads in a much larger tapestry, right? Each one influences the others in really profound ways. These insights hopefully help you discern the true forces that are shaping our political and economic future, let you look beyond just the daily headlines and grasp those deeper currents at play.
So what does this all mean for you? As we've seen today, what happens when political decisions may be driven by short-term gains or ideological purity or even just, you know, internal disorganization, what happens when those clash with long-term economic realities or with established institutional norms? And how much does a strong declaration from a politician or an administration truly shape reality when it runs up against these powerful underlying trends we've talked about? Something to consider as you move through your week.